The viewpoints expressed in the following program are not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. The following program contains subject matter and realistic language that some listeners may find objectionable. Listener discretion is advised. Well, good afternoon, Savannah. It is just past 12 o'clock on this rainy Friday afternoon, and that means you are now listening to Literature with Lee and PT. PT, are you staying warm over there?
Just barely.
I know. Barely. It's a little chilly in the studio today, isn't it?
It is. I am to the point where it's challenging for me to stay warm even in shoulder weather, and this is a little beyond shoulder weather.
Right. Well, you and I, we just sat in for Brian Redder on Beyond the Liner Notes, where we did a theme show about winter and winter songs, but woven into some of those songs were songs by veterans of different military, different wars, or songs about wars. And today, that's what you and I want to talk about on Listening to Literature.
Indeed we do. And more specifically, not so much the day and the fine speeches and all that attends it, but the viewpoint of the veteran, the person who served themselves.
Right. Because, you know, here in this country, we had our Veterans Day, obviously, on November the 11th. But this, of course, is a holiday named variously that is celebrated in many different places.
It absolutely is. And it's Remembrance Day, it's Armistice Day. It's all tied up with World War One, I believe.
Right. So it started a year after World War One, right, as Armistice Day. I have an excerpt from the address that President Woodrow Wilson gave to those who served in World War One, and he gave this address on November the 11th, 1919, right? So a year after our armistice with Germany. And why November the 11th? Why 11/11, PT? Can you tell our listeners who might not already know, though they probably do, that, right, that the truce was signed on the 11th hour of the 11th day of
yes,
the 11th month,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So November the 11th. And let me give our listeners a little bit from Woodrow Wilson's speech. He said, and this was November 11th, 1919, "A year ago today, our enemies laid down their arms in accordance with an armistice, which rendered them impotent to renew hostilities and gave to the world an assured opportunity to reconstruct its shattered order and to work out in peace a new and juster set of international relations. To us in America, the reflections of Armistice Day will be filled with solemn pride in the heroism of those who died in the country's service and with gratitude for the victory, both because of the thing from which it has freed us and because of the opportunity it has given America to show her sympathy with peace and justice in the councils of nations."
Wonderful words. Would that the years that passed after that had met the reality.
Absolutely right. And of course, many wars came afterwards. But World War One, the Great War, the war to end all wars, was not to be that.
No,
right?
it wasn't. But it set the tone. And in fact, if you are in Russia, the date of the end of World War II is a national holiday that is celebrated beyond anything we do here for any holiday. People go home for it from other countries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
It's a big deal. And, of course, all these things happened because these countries suffered so badly during those bad times.
Right. And so... we don't call it Armistice Day here anymore. It changed to Veterans Day.
Veterans Day, and I think
after World War II, right? June of 1954, it was Congress amended. You know, Congress set forth some legislation that President Eisenhower signed into law. So Veterans Day, and then a little while later, 1968, there was a uniform holiday bill that said, "Hey, look, we need to make holidays, you know, uniform, so that we could have 3-day weekends."
3-day weekends.
So Veterans Day was going to become an official Monday holiday, but there was a lot of pushback against that because November the 11th, the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month has significant meaning. And so by 1975, under President Ford, it was officially set back to November the 11th, no matter on what day of the week it falls.
Yeah. And of course, I'm not clear on that because the numerology didn't really work out well at all.
It did not. But and you and I, PT, we talked back in May about Memorial Day, which is similar but not quite the same. You know, Veterans Day is here to honor veterans of all wars, both living and deceased.
And more to the point, we are not honoring the people, the men and women who were victimized by the war, who became casualties, deaths. We are honoring all veterans.
All veterans.
And I think that's richly deserved.
Absolutely. Including, I would say, the ones who are currently serving.
Absolutely.
Who will become veterans, but they're active service people.
Yeah. And of course, right now, we have an all-volunteer army. And in years past, the emphasis of most of the literature I've seen has been more on the recruit or the draftee who was thrown into this, and I think that's a little unfair.
Right. One of the things I was thinking about this week when we decided we wanted to focus a literature-based show, writing-based show around veterans, and we'll get to that literature aspect here soon, but thinking about how we talk about veterans as if they're one thing or one type of identity, but veterans come from all walks of life. Like you were saying,
they do.
There were some who were drafted, some who have chosen a military path, some from different socioeconomic areas in our country, from different regions of our country. And some veterans have been honored more readily than others.
They have. That goes back, I think, to what I was saying. And the fact is that whether you decide to spend your entire career in the military or you don't, you face the same dangers. And in fact, people who make the military career serve them probably more frequently or over a greater number of years than somebody who simply enlists and then goes and does something else.
Right. So we want to talk about veterans and veterans' perspectives from many different vantage points, not just as if they are all one entity that we're just going to honor one day per year and just say thank you for your service. How do we honor our veterans and how do we respect them?
My particular answer would be not nearly enough.
Not nearly enough. That's right.
And the reason for that is if you look at the things that have gone on in this country, worldwide, after wars, veterans come home. They come home to societies that are transitioning, shall we say. And they tend to make a great big difference in how those society works because they've seen the very worst that humanity can provide. And they are intent that the old ways that are really kind of meaningless don't pertain anymore. This happened after World War I.
Nice.
Especially in Britain, there's a gorgeous book written about that by Robert Graves.
Tell us a little bit about Graves's book, if you don't mind.
I don't. Not at all, because it's one of my favorites. It's an autobiography. It's called Goodbye to All That. It's mostly actually an account of his time during the war. But in the last several chapter, he goes into his post-war adventures, which weren't very adventurous. He had his fill of adventure by that time. But the one thing that comes through to me is that the war instilled in the survivors of the trenches and so forth a tremendous determination they wanted to build a life for themselves that was free of the pre-war convention, which was pretty stifling. And, well, for example, Graves went to Oxford after the war, and he quotes Adon as saying, "I can't make out my students at all. They're all yes, sir, and no, sir. They seem positively to thirst for knowledge and scribble away in their notebooks like lunatics. I can't remember a single instance of such endeavor in the old days." And now this was a Don who had served in the war and was actually a prisoner of war for a while. But it's not just the academic learning that gets to them. It's they see things that are wrong and they want to fix them. He goes on, the ex-servicemen, who included scores of captains, majors, colonels, and even a one-armed 25-year-old brigadier, insisted on their rights. At St. John's, they formed the College Soviet, successfully demanding an entire revision of the scandalous catering system, and chose an undergraduate to serve on the kitchen committee. Now, this is Oxford. This is one of the most tradition-bound institutions in a very kind of tradition-bound country.
Absolutely.
And so this was big stuff. A lot of the post-war soldiers took a broader view and in their politics became socialist simply because they felt that the old way wasn't working anymore. And others of them actually became national socialists, which kind of set up the years that followed.
Right.
And we have a parallel in this country, too. The scores of men who came back from World War II went to college on the GI Bill, did all those things that were necessary, and academia reacted to them the same way. What on earth is going on?
Right.
These people actually want to learn.
Right.
And they went out and made real interesting and significant lives for themselves. And when we talk about the greatest generation, I think some people miss that. They focus more on the war than what came after and
right.
and the really beneficial effect these people had on the society after.
Right. Now, P.T., I have actually two poems talking about veterans after World War II, but before I get that relate a little bit to Graves' book, maybe not quite the same, but a little bit to what you're talking about. But before we get to that, one of the things I do also want to add is we also see, so after World War I, where we had several hundred thousand African-American personnel serving in World War I, they come back after the war to a society that's, you know, embroiled in Jim Crow laws, particularly, you know, here in the South. And so you're right. They went and they served our country. They had more freedoms and saw some of the freedoms they had while they were in Europe.
Right.
And they come back to a society that doesn't recognize the service that they provided and puts them in a position where they have far fewer rights than they had when they were overseas defending the rights we have here at home.
That's absolutely true. And not so much World War I, but World War II.
Well, as well.
There are several instances where black veterans were refused the benefits of the GI Bill.
Right. And there was also, I was just reading an article about this, there was also differential ways that the GI Bill was handled because the funding was handled, I believe, at a state level.
Right.
And so the hard part is that a lot of our African-American personnel and others coming back from World War II even were still facing unequal access, even though there was federal funding for this education.
And in some states, no access at all.
And in some states, no access at all. Now, one of the poems I pulled talking about veterans coming home after World War II is from a poetry book called Red Peony Night by Helen Conkling. And this poem is called Veterans in 1946. It it doesn't have quite the same optimism that you were talking about, PT. But it is interesting to get this perspective that Graves talks about in relation to the dawn in his book. So veterans in 1946, they came to the universities after the war, and some, survivors of Anzio, Corregidor, Normandy, were still surprised by the fact they were alive, something more than a name on a cross. They wore good clothes to class, white shirts, jackets. They were formal young men from small towns and city neighborhoods, and this was how they dressed for school. Never at a loss, they took part in class discussions, saying what they thought, and wrote English themes on subjects such as a definition of beauty and reality and illusion in Conrad's victory. By November, when dark fell early, they'd already talked about how their wives were taking it and when the babies were expected. So now they discussed the girls in chemistry, advanced level, who would naturally get A's coming right out of high school, not having their lives mutilated by the war. Stoddard Edward, Lieberman James, Savola Robert, every semester their names were called, and they answered there in quiet rooms, after reading all night what the past had written down for them, before choosing, according to their ways, what to remember. So that was Helen Conkling's Veterans in 1946.
Right. And you have to remember, and this is probably more in tune with her poem, that a lot of these people were coming back with things they had to get over.
Yes,
they had seen and experienced some terrible things.
Right.
Even Graves goes into the fact that for 10 years after the war, he couldn't ride on a train. It brought back too many memories.
Right. And we have, from millennia ago to the current day, we have named this various things. After World War I, it was shell shock. Right now, we talk about PTSD.
And I think PTSD, although usually I hate modern terms, is probably a much better, much more descriptive term. And one of the reasons that I thought this would be a good show to do is we read an awful lot about soldiers in battle, but we read really very little by soldiers,
right?
Or except in battle, about their veteran life,
right? Absolutely, about their veteran. Although there are a lot of poetry does talk about veterans and veteran life in various ways. But you're absolutely right in terms of sort of prose and stories and films based off of
right
longer stories.
And there you start running into kind of strange conventions too, because if you have somebody who's out there doing bad, crazy stuff an awful lot of the time, it's a veteran who has PTSD, which is that's difficult for me.
Right. So, PT, here's that second poem that sort of relates to veterans coming back from a war and especially going to university and coming back to their normal life. This is a poem called Star Spangled by Michelle Glazer. It's out of a book of poems called Outsiders, poems about rebels, exiles, and renegades that's been edited by Laura Ann Bosselaar. So this is Michelle Glazer, Star Spangled. One man won't say anything. One says over to himself, "Oh, say, can you see anything?" The world rolls under his tongue as a muddy river enjoins the bank. Join me or watch me roll on. 14 years later, and he's still fresh home from Nam. If he could just tell his story, he'd get a better job, more money, his health back. If he had time, doing it would be easy as two sticks. Afraid of missing something, he leans forward. What is the difference between a subject and a noun? Why do we need both? Do rhetorical questions get question marks? Why do we need both? How does it feel to be back? I want to ask him. And how does it feel to be you? His secret is he knows he doesn't belong here. One night I bring a cutout. White on black or black on white is the question. Is it a vase or two faces seen in profile and from a long distance? Did the tailback who injured his knee recently return to practice? Or did he recently return? That night the weather turns. All night everything will happen under one color. In the middle of a class he gets up, walks out into it. Apostrophe show possession, says one woman after he leaves. But if you just say it, you don't need them. One night, in the middle of his question, he stops. His words turn back to him suddenly. A black funneling of swifts down a chimney. It is a mystery why they choose one chimney over another and how so many birds fit inside. Mm. Yes, right, Michelle Glaser, P.T. I just happened upon this poem, but is, I think, one of my favorites now.
Along with my theme of voices of the veterans themselves, there are actually a few books by veterans about the problems of transition, and PTSD does play a big role in that.
But not the only role.
But not the only role, certainly not. Two books that do deal with the PTSD, one's called Locked In, A Soldier and Civilian Struggle with the Invisible Wounds. That's by Carolyn Furtick, who is a veteran. And another is called The Things They Cannot Say, Stories Soldiers Won't Tell You About What They've Seen, Done, or Failed to Do. That's by Kevin Seitz. Both of these people write compellingly and non-academically about their experiences in making the transition back to civilian life. And there is always that doubt, as the poem said, that they're not quite sure they belong here.
Right. And we civilians have done sometimes a better job and sometimes a very terrible job of making those veterans feel at home. Now, Peachy, we're almost up to our halfway mark already. Going along with what you were talking about with the books by Furtick and Kevin Seitz, here's another poem by Walter McDonald that I'll leave our listeners with, and then we'll break for a very brief moment for station identification and a few announcements. This is also from that Outsiders book I was quoting earlier. This is Walter McDonald, After the Noise of Saigon. If where we hunt defines us, then stalking this steep hillside dark with spruce makes sense. More than the dreams I've floundered in for years, trying to fathom signs all night and wading ashore, disgusted. Switches dripping sap keep flipping me when I glance over my shoulder for spore I might have missed. Evergreen needles sting when I swing my head, face forward for clues. Isn't this the strangest nightmare of all? Knowing my aim with a bow is no better at 20 yards than 40. But here I am, alone with a cougar I've stalked for hours, climbing until I'm dizzy. These blue trees have nothing and all to do with what I'm here for after the noise of Saigon. The simple bitter sap that rises in me like bad blood I need to spill out here alone in the silence of deep woods. Far from people I know who see me as a friend, not some damned madman stumbling for his life.
This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings Community Radio with Global Soul.
The Live Oak Public Library System offers local residents access to hundreds of thousands of movies, television programs, albums, audiobooks, ebooks, and digital comic books for free on your streaming television and mobile devices through the Hoopla app. Supported devices include Roku, Fire, Apple TV, iPhone, and Android, among others. The selection is vast. All you'll need is your library card. Find the Hoopla app on your device and more information at liveoakpl.org.
How many times have you heard WRUU's corporate underwriting message? If you remember it, then your potential customers will remember your message as well. We are offering this space to connect corporate and institutional partners with our loyal and active listeners. Underwriting on WRUU is short, so listeners don't tune out. It's exclusive, so your message won't be lost in advertising clutter, and it supports Savannah's only community radio station. For a marketing package to increase your reach beyond traditional media, email underwriting@wruu.org.
Well, welcome back to Listening to Literature on WRUU 107.5 FM. You're listening to Lee and PT. Today we are talking about literature, books, poems, and letters that speak to veterans, are written by veterans in honor of Veterans Day.
Right. There are a tremendous number of books about combat, about battlefield exploits.
Right. The height of the war, the height of being in the trenches.
Right. Start with the Iliad. and that's one genre. But we kind of wanted to look at what happened after the battle, right, after the demobilization. Right. And there isn't a lot of literature on that, but there is some, and it's pretty powerful stuff.
Right. And, PJ, that's why I pulled a lot of poems this week, some letters and some speeches, not just from our presidents, but speeches that weave in letters from actual people, veterans, loved ones of veterans, and maybe we'll get to those. Before the break, I read that poem by Walter MacDonald, After the Noise of Saigon, that I think speaks to some of the books you were talking about a little bit earlier, written by veterans about not just the PTSD, but what is life like coming back from the from a war?
Right.
Yeah.
I think when we do Veterans Day celebrations, when we look at how we treat veterans,
yes,
I think we probably don't pay enough attention to what the veterans themselves are telling us, because there are things they need help with. And this goes way beyond PTSD and all those other things that have kind of become
right,
more popular.
And Pete, I don't want to interrupt your thought here. We'll come back to your line,
sure,
of thinking. But this goes along with that. If you're a history fan, one aspect of veterans post-war that you might know about is the bonus marchers from 1932.
Yes.
So these are veterans from World War I who were promised a bonus by 1945, but of course in the early 1930s, we're in the middle of the Great Depression.
And there's absolutely no chance of them getting that bonus.
Right,
so
and of
they
course,
protested.
And they were in desperate need, and they protested in and around Washington, D.C., and our army came in and forced them out.
Yes, led incidentally by an officer by the name of Douglas MacArthur.
Yes. President Hoover in 1931 at an American Legion gave a speech, September 21st, 1931, called the Veterans Bonus, to try to talk with a lot of these veterans about how he supported the veterans, how he wanted to ensure that Congress had enough in his budget to pay for veterans' benefits, but that we were in the middle of a Great Depression, and therefore he talked with them about, you know, sort of sometimes what we hear today in our corporate world of we're in a down budget time. We can't, you know, we respect what you've done. We can't quite pay for you now. Here's what we're thinking in terms of process. And so here's a couple of just excerpts from President Hoover's The Veterans Bonus speech, where he says, "I need not recount to you that the world is passing through a Great Depression." I think the veterans and everyone else very much understood that. And then he goes on to say, "The world war in which your service brought bloodshed to an end and gave hope of reconstruction to the world." And he really tried to highlight that, you know, he wanted adequate and generous provision for our disabled veterans, as well as the veterans who had been promised this bonus. A little bit later, he says, "The imperative moment has come in our history when increase in government expenditures must be avoided, whether it be ill-considered, hasty, or uninformed legislation of any kind, or whether it be for new services meritorious in themselves. No man can doubt the charter and idealism of men who have gone into the trenches in defense of their country." But so here he is talking to veterans saying, look, we need to put off your bonus and your benefits because we have to take a look at the whole country as a whole. And rightfully so, the veterans were not quite happy about
this.
No,
they weren't. And another facet to that is Hoover probably meant every word he said. People don't remember that Hoover was one of the men who did a whole lot of Reconstruction after the First World War. He very much had a social conscience, but in his presidency, he simply didn't have the budget. The same words out of Calvin Coolidge's mouth probably would have taken a year, but above and beyond that, Coolidge might not have been sincere as Hoover was.
Right.
Hoover, in comparison to some of the other political figures of his era, was kind of a progressive guy, and it was just his bad luck that it was he who got broiled by the Depression.
Absolutely. And of course, we have FDR who comes in next. And
right.
I'm quoting here from a book by Gary Dean Best, FDR and the Bonus Marchers, 1933 to 1935. Now, under FDR, FDR basically offered to many of these World War One veterans work in the Civilian Conservation Corps at $1 a day plus food, clothing, and shelter. After some initial complaints at the low pay, most of the veterans accepted the offer, the others being provided transportation back to their homes by the federal government. So by June 1933, you had about 2,600 veterans who had accepted this offer, and FDR was really praised by the press for how well he handled this in comparison to Hoover. But as you were just saying, PT, that comparison might not be quite so fair.
Well, I think actually it is fair.
Is it?
Because Hoover was still living within the bounds of the pre-war economy and the people who ran the pre-war economy. Roosevelt understood that all that had to change.
And he
did several things.
Yeah, he definitely made that change. Now, in Gary Dean Best's book, FDR and the Bonus Marchers, unfortunately, more tragedy came about for many of these bonus marchers. Many of them who were working for the Federal Emergency Relief Administration or the Civilian Conservation Corps were working down in the Florida Keys. And in 1935, as Best talks about, he says, an incredibly violent hurricane, and accompanying
right.
tidal wave struck the Florida Keys. Now, a lot of the veterans were away from the camps at that time or on furlough, but the federal government's count was about at least 256 veterans lost their lives that day. And interestingly enough, Ernest Hemingway, who, of course, had a home in the Keys and, you know, spent time there, wrote many of it, not as much time as other places, but wrote many of his books there. I'm quoting the book by by Gary Dean Best, who's also quoting Hemingway here. In September 1935, Ernest Hemingway wrote of the consequences of that policy for over 250 veterans. Quoting Hemingway, "You're dead now, brother. But who left you there in the hurricane months on the Keys, where 1,000 men died before you in the months when they were building the road that's now washed out? Who left you there? And what's the punishment for manslaughter now?"
Right. And again, this was progressive well beyond the bounds that the pre-Depression politics would have stood for. So even that was an advance on what the bonus marchers had been offered.
Right.
You know, Lee, we've talked about books, we've talked about poems, we've talked about articles, but we live in a modern world, okay?
Yes, where the written word exists in other venues.
Yes, they do.
And you found a very interesting take in one of these other venues by a veteran himself.
I did. I was looking for something that would give me a veteran's opinion or maybe several veterans' opinions of what they saw, and I didn't come up with much, but I came up with something that really impressed me. On the net, there is a site called Stone Kettle Station. It's written by a fellow by the name of Jim Wright. He is an ex-chief warrant officer in the Navy, and he has all sorts of opinions based on being a veteran and watching society, too.
And how we should honor veterans.
Right. He is an author, but he mostly deals with online stuff, and the Stone Kettle Station often has essays that kind of surprise you coming from a career military man, but they're interesting for that. One of his biggest issues, this comes up every year, is he's started with a Veterans Day essay,
commentary, I guess. Essay, yes.
Yeah.
Essay's a good word.
And there for a while he was changing it every year, and now he's more or less discovered or decided really that he's done with it. And
he has said his piece, but
he said his
that
piece.
Doesn't mean that we can't keep reading it every year.
Right.
Because we should.
Right. He is actually an author. He's written some fiction. It's in a collection called Alternative Truths. But looking into the mind of a veteran, why does a person become a veteran in the first place? Why do they go in? According to him, he went in to prove something to himself about himself and to grow. And another thing that was interesting to me is he mentioned the role of a novel, a science fiction novel called Starship Troopers. It was written by Robert Heinlein, who is kind of a deity in the science fiction world. And this brings in the role of science fiction, too, because quite often in science fiction, people use all these fantastic or maybe off-world or maybe fantasy-type situations to say something pretty acute about how we as humans live and who we as humans are. And this is one of those books. Incidentally, Heinlein himself was a graduate of the Naval Academy.
Yes.
Right. And served in the interwar Navy. Anyway, if you look at Heinlein, he wrote his three masterworks are Starship Troopers, Stranger in a Strange Land, and The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. And they're all about societies that have lost their interest in the members. The government is actually considered kind of an antagonist. And that would, in Stranger in a Strange Land, that would be the Fosterites, I guess. They demand obedience, and that's it. And Heinlein's characters rebel against this, usually in military ways. And so that was a source of fascination for Wright.
Right. But many people have critiqued Starship Troopers as being too pro-military, too pro-war. And this is one of the things that Wright is reacting to.
Yeah, because he's saying that if you want to talk to somebody who knows for sure how horrible war is, for heaven's sakes, you have to talk to somebody who's been through it. They're perfectly aware of how bad it is. And I think people are mistaking his disdain for civilian government gone wrong with championing the military that's rebelling against it. I don't think it's necessarily that the military is the answer to everything. It's just that when when the civilian governments stop paying attention to the individual, then something has to happen. Heinlein was very interested in the abuses of civilian governments. Of course, in his era, you had some extremely abusive ones. The Soviet system goes without saying, the system that was in China, and some others as well. Right. So all this has something to do with Wright, and the novel is actually, in some cases, called a philosophical novel, right, as well as a science fiction novel.
Now, out of Wright's essay, I mean, something you were just speaking about, P.T., Wright actually says, there is no one who knows the terrible cost of war more than a veteran. I think you maybe even had read that a little bit earlier. But here Wright is talking about how, like you said, he found himself in the military, and this is part of who he is. And a little bit later in his essay, he talks about how, you know, maybe on Memorial Day, maybe on Veterans Day, we might honor our veterans here or there, maybe in great ways, maybe in not so great ways. And then he says, but after the wreaths are laid and the flags are lowered and the trumpets sound their mournful call, then the politicians will return to the same old divisions, the tax bill, the latest pork barrel project, or how the other party is unpatriotic and un-American. Tomorrow, they'll remember us not at all.
Right. And he even sees this translated into literature. He says, it's okay to write about war, to set novels among the conflagration and tell tales of glory and honor and sacrifice, so long as those who are caught up in its horror resent their own service, so long as they despise the conflict and the government and the utter ridiculous stupidity which sent them into the meat grinder. It's okay to tell stories of war and conflict as long as the hero is serving only out of duty and will return to civilian life once the war ends, or die heroically or tragically or foolishly, depending on what kind of story you're telling. And his point here is that he found a home in the military. The military is a good home for a lot of people. And those people tend to feel a little left out by these Veteran Day exercises.
Right. And I've heard, and Wright intimates this and says it a little bit more concretely in a certain way, but I've also heard other active service members or veterans, you know, say, look, you know, don't thank us, or just don't give us platitudes.
He says that specifically.
Right, specifically. And Wright comes out and says, look, you need to just respect us. That's what we're asking for.
We do. Going a little further, we honor those who came of their own free will and came, those who only came because they were called. We honor those who came of age in bloody conflict, and those like me, like the protagonist of that novel, Starship Troopers, found a life for ourselves in military, and we honor those who resented every bloody, miserable, senseless minute of it. And he uses a synonym for bloody.
Yes, right. that we are going to, with his permission, yeah, change a little bit on air. Now, PT, we only have 10 minutes left here, barely scratching the surface to talk about veterans' perspectives, veterans' stories, and literature about veterans. But in about 10 minutes at the top of the hour, you can stick around for Tim Hogenboom with A Knot Fade Away. Maybe in our...
I'm not going to stick around, but I'm going to listen.
On the way. That's right. There are various ways you can tune into that.
Right.
Maybe in our last 10 minutes, I pulled some poetry about soldiers and veterans. I don't know, we won't get through all of it, but maybe we can talk about a few of them. The first one is by Melvin Tolson, who was an American poet, 1898 to 1966. He was a little bit more of a modernist poet. He studied the Harlem Renaissance and was very much shaped by the Harlem Renaissance. He also was a debate coach in Texas, where he fostered interracial debates in Jim Crow South between white teams and black teams. And actually, there's a 2007 biopic called The Great Debaters that stars Denzel Washington, produced by Oprah, about Tolson. I'm going to give you just a couple of stanzas out of his poem, The Unknown Soldier. I was a minute man at Concord Bridge. I was a frigate gunner on Lake Erie. I was a mortar man at Stony Ridge. I fought at San Juan Hill and Chateau Thierry. I braved Corregidor and the Arctic Sea. The index finger brings democracy. These states bred freedom in and in my bone. Old is the New Testament of Plymouth Bay, when the founding fathers laid the cornerstone, and rude the 13 clocks that would not say the hour on the hour. I nerved myself with them, under the noose in the hand of the tyrant's whim. I am the unknown soldier. I open doors to the rights of man, letters incarnadine. These shrines of freedom are mine as well as yours, these ashes of freemen yours as well as mine. My troubled ghost shall haunt these states, nor cease till the global war becomes a global peace.
Yes, whenever that does happen.
Right.
Jim Wright goes there, too, and he is not optimistic about anything anytime
soon. I think anyone who writes either about war or about the human condition, sometimes we vacillate between hope and maybe despair. Now, Sophie Jewett, who also wrote under the pseudonym Ellen Burroughs, was a poet and a professor at Wellesley College. Mm-hmm. She lived 1861 to 1909. She has a poem called Armistice. The water sings along our keel. The wind falls to a whispering breath. I look into your eyes and feel no fear of life or death. So near is love, so far away, the losing strife of yesterday. We watch the swallow skim and dip. Some magic bids the world be still. Life stands with finger upon lip. Love hath his gentle will. Though hearts have bled and tears have burned, the river floweth unconcerned. We pray the fickle flag of truth still float deceitfully and fair. Our eyes must love its sweet abuse. This hour we will not care, though just beyond tomorrow's gate, arrayed and strong, the battle wait.
Ah.
Yes, so that speaks a little bit to, yes, we seek peace, but we know that how long can it last?
Well, conflict is inevitable in any human society. One would hope that we can keep it manageable, i.e., before we start trying to off each other. But that doesn't happen very often.
Right, right. P.T., you had said something a little bit earlier, and this also goes along with Wright's piece, about how the soldier knows better than all of us, than the veteran knows better than all of us what war is like. Douglas MacArthur has a quote about this where he once said in a speech in 1962 to West Point cadets, "The soldier above all other people prays for peace, for he must suffer and bear the deepest wounds and scars of war."
Right. And going back to Wright, he says, "We are not heroes. Most of us, anyway, we're simply people like any others, doing the best we can with what we have under difficult circumstances. We came when called and did our duty, each for our own reasons. You don't have to understand why, just as you may not understand why a fireman would run into a burning building instead of in the other direction. Just as you may never understand why Heinlein wrote what he wrote." And that's the point. Sometimes when it comes to the war dead or the veterans or various different other groups, we tend to create these mythologies that don't really marry up with the things that the veterans, for example, really want and need. Instead, it becomes kind of a big party. And yet we run into situations, in my personal opinion, the Veterans Administration has been underfunded for years. I have seen more and more bureaucracy attached to the benefits that the veterans are supposed to get. Nothing is easy. And if we really want to honor the veterans, maybe we should go in a different direction.
Maybe in a different direction, absolutely. So we only have about 3.5 minutes left, PT. So let me see if I can give our listeners maybe two more poems. I would like to end on one that might be a nod of respect and hopefully to our veterans, and hopefully they can, you know, get some deserved rest, but I'll wait for that one. The first one is Dreamers by Siegfried Sassoon, who was an English poet and writer, right? A major poet around World War I, was also honored for his heroism and bravery on the Western Front. So this
contemporary,
is
contemporary. Matter of fact, he and Graves knew each other quite well.
Okay, I did not realize that, PT. Yeah. All right, so Dreamers. Soldiers are citizens of death's gray land, drawing no dividend from time's tomorrows. In the great hour of destiny they stand, each with his feuds and jealousies and sorrows. Soldiers are sworn to action. They must win some flaming fatal conflicts with their lives. Soldiers are dreamers when the guns begin. They think of firelit homes, clean beds, and wives. I see them in foul dugouts gnawed by rats, and in the ruined trenches lashed with rain, dreaming of things they did with balls and bats, and mocked by hopeless longing to regain bank holidays and picture shows and spats, and going to the office in the train.
Yeah.
Right.
Siegfried Sassoon was one of the prime poets of that era. Did you have another?
Yes, we have one more. I think we have just enough time to squeeze it in. This is called Soldier from the Wars Returning by A.E. Houseman, another English poet, a little bit more of a classicist. But here's to our veterans of yesterday, of today, of tomorrow, here and abroad. Soldier from the Wars Returning. Soldier from the wars returning, spoiler of the taken town, here is ease that asks not earning, turn you in and sit you down. Peace is come and wars are over, welcome you and welcome all, while the charger crops the clover and his bridle hangs in stall. Now no more of winter's biting, filth and trench from fall to spring, summer's full of sweat and fighting for the Kaiser or the King. Rest you, charger, rest you, bridle. Kings and kaisers, keep your pay. Soldier, sit you down and idle at the inn of night for aye. All right, on that note, PT, I think we will thank our veterans and thank all of our listeners for listening to Literature with us here today on
Absolutely.
WRUU 107.5 FM. So good day and good reading.
Bye, y'all.
The viewpoints expressed in the preceding program were not necessarily those of WRUU, its license holder, or its staff. This is WRUU-LP, Savannah, Georgia, 107.5 FM, WRUU.org. We are Savannah Soundings, community radio with global soul.